Hi everyone and welcome to the session. We've got Claire Braden with us from Pittsburgh and Nina Liakos is just outside of Washington, and they're both enjoying temperatures of around -6 Celsius or 21 degrees Fahrenheit. And I'm in Adelaide, Australia, where the temperature was 42 degrees Celsius today, but it's dropped back to a nice warm, balmy 25 degrees. And the topic for this Learning Together session is designing learning in the digital age. So I might just give Nina a chance to say hi, and I'm sure Claire will say hi in the text chat. So Nina?
So hi to all you millions of webheads who subscribe to this podcast. I'm so glad to say hello to you today.
Yeah, and it's always good to acknowledge the people who are not here but who might well listen to this at a later date. So if you're listening in asynchronous mode, yeah, welcome and hope you enjoy it. I'll just create a little bit of context here for this question and why I put this forward as a topic together with a colleague of mine. We recently ran a one-day workshop on this topic, and it was something of a disaster, I must say, because we actually pitched it as the kind of event where people would come prepared to do a lot of talking and interacting with each other and using social media to create content and things like Twitter and Instagram or Facebook or whatever. And it was really strange because the short of it is that people came along expecting my colleague and I to talk at them about this topic, and that was never our intention. And we thought it was a little bit ironic that given my understanding of what designing learning in the digital age is all about, where part of that means that the teacher is off stage or away from the front of the room to a greater extent, that people still came along expecting to be filled up with knowledge about this topic. So we're going to run it again in Melbourne in March, and we're going to do it very differently, and we are going to run it with a lot more guidance and structure and spoon feeding because it clearly didn't work. But I've been thinking very hard about this topic for a while now, and I just think it would be interesting to ask ourselves this question to begin with. How is the digital age any different? So when we're talking about designing learning, we're all teachers here, and webheads are teachers, or the majority of them are. If not in classrooms, they're teachers in life. How is designing learning for the digital age any different than it ever was, is the first question. So what have I got here? Well, we'll go back to that first. So Nina or Claire, what's different about the digital age?
Well, in my situation, it doesn't have to be different, I guess, because I'm still meeting with my students every day in a classroom. My classrooms are not always smart. All of my students have smartphones. I don't have one, which they are constantly doing something with, and I'm constantly telling them not to, and thinking I should be using these, but I don't know how. I use a blog or a wiki or both. I use email. I use the internet for teaching, for getting resources for the students, but I don't know. I'm not sure how to answer that question. It's different, I guess, because the students are constantly being distracted by their media, by their mobile devices. But they have the same language difficulties that they ever had before. Is that not the answer that you're listening, that you're looking for?
Well, I wasn't looking for any particular answer, but I think you've kind of tapped into something that I'd been thinking when I think closely about this topic, is that we tend to, there's a lot of what have almost become platitudes, cliches about the digital age. And I suppose one easy way of answering this question of how is the digital age any different is that it's digital. That is, there's technology involved, which didn't exist 5, 10, 20 years ago. But lots of things remain the same, as you've indicated, Nina. And I think with a lot of people who teach language, my guess is if they're teaching people at a fairly low level of language, that is the target language, then lots of things are going to be very difficult to manage in this digital age. And you flagged the issue of because students all have smartphones, which they're mucking around with all the time. You don't, and you can't. So let's move on to the next question. And Claire, I'll presume you'll drop things into the text chat as things occur to you, or if you think it's appropriate to add something. And a closely connected question with this one, of course, is we teach, therefore we have in mind outcomes for our students, and outcomes can be called skills and knowledge. So what skills are needed for the digital age? There's a definite article missing there on that slide, but so if we're thinking about a digital age and if we're designing learning, are we after different skills? Are we after the same skills? So I know these are hard questions without notice, Nina, and because you're the only other person here who's kind of mic activated, you're going to cop the brunt of this. So any thoughts, Nina? Well, Claire's added a few examples there, so I'll just read them. Ability to create and edit media, for example, text, images, audio, video. So Nina, no, I won't lead you. I'll just let you answer this question cold. Can we just brainstorm up on the board what skills are needed for the digital age? Claire, when you say the ability to create and edit media, now that's a very digital focused skills. It's focusing on the technology. Are there other things beneath the ability to do that with technology that are important in terms of skills and knowledge? I mean, what's the bigger picture behind being able to create and edit media? Yeah, literacy indeed. And what's your preferred term, Claire? We've got a multitude of literacies, and if Vance were here, we could get him to talk about his course, Multiliteracy. Is that the phrase you use? There's information literacy, there's critical literacy, there's digital literacy. Don't have a preferred term? Okay, I'm not sure whether I do. I think I probably rest on the digital literacy as a kind of come all ye title or umbrella term for literacy in general. Nina, do you have a preferred kind of literacy that you refer to?
I'm not sure what you mean by that. Having taken Vance's multiliteracies session in EVO a couple of years ago, but right at the moment, most of my students are lower level Saudi students, and literacy is a huge issue for these students. They're coming from an oral culture. They, for the most part, do not read for pleasure or even for information in their first language. They are coming from a different script, which is written in a different direction. And they tend to be extremely poor readers in English, poor writers. So when I think of literacy for my students, I'm really thinking of the very lowest level, which is decoding. You know, understanding what you read, whether it's on a screen or on a test or in a book or in a magazine. That is literacy for my students. They're unable, in many cases, to handle even such a low level. That said, there are lots of other literacies, and they can all use their cell phones. So, I mean, it's not like they can't do it, but they're kind of resistant to the practice. You know, I keep telling them, if you want to learn how to read well, you have to read. But they want to know how to read well when they need it, but they don't actually like reading, so they don't spend time reading other than the texts in Arabic that they're sent on their phones. It's kind of frustrating.
I was always torn with this issue, not only when there was with technology, but when students in the classroom were basically communicating with each other in their own language, and of course English being the target language, was only being used when communicating with me or when I initiated conversations through classwork where English was to be the language of use. It's kind of a sidetrack, but I always grappled with the fact that why would people who are from the same language background, who share a common language, why would they stumble around trying to communicate to each other in English when they've got Arabic or Farsi or, you know, Spanish as their mother tongue? I just want to flag the video literacy one. So Claire's mentioned that in the age of YouTube, and you can see it happening now. I mean, the more that you look at YouTube, the more I'm impressed by the level of skills that people have to create really quite good amateur video. So it's not just turning the camera on and letting it run for a few minutes. They're creating scenes, and they're editing scenes, they're shooting scenes which they're joining together, they're overlaying soundtracks, or they've got, you know, on-screen annotations as well as the other kinds of things. They're almost a default level of literacy now that is quite prevalent among, and I think it is mostly a younger generation, generations X and Y, that they, a large number of them do by default have very impressive video literacy skills. And according to Julie Salmon, that's just going to become more and more a necessity for kind of active and full participation in modern life. So I wonder, Nina, what do your students do when if they don't read for pleasure and they don't write for pleasure, what do they do? I mean, are they media literate, I guess is the question.
Well, I don't know what they do when they're home. What I've read about Arab culture, I mean, not that I have only Arab students, but let's take the majority right now. What I've read about Arab culture is that they spend a lot of time talking. I don't know if my students are young, but I think that, you know, articulateness of speech is very admired and respected in those cultures. But what I see my students doing is, you know, when we're in the computer lab, so I can see what they're doing, often they're watching sports, soccer games or stuff like that. I had one student about a year ago who spent a lot of time looking at pictures of himself, but I don't think he was typical. I don't know. I mean, many of them don't spend much time on homework, I can tell you that. One student told me that he didn't do homework. He just wasn't going to do it no matter what I told him. He told me that. He used to take the metro really far away from us, you know, to the other side of Washington, and watch movies. I asked him why he didn't watch movies closer to home, and he said he didn't know there were any. I mean, he was kind of an interesting case. He's no longer with us. Yeah, I don't know who asked the question. Maybe Michael, is it different across cultures? I think, yeah, it's different from individual to individual. I had one student this semester in his 40s with a wife and five kids at home, a Saudi, and he spent all of his time running around at the beginning of the semester trying to find a house for them that, you know, would have enough bedrooms, and then trying to get four of his five kids into the public school system, and they ended up in three different schools. He had no time for studying because he had so many family responsibilities that he was trying to cope with.
I'm reminded of a time years ago when I spent quite a lot of time in Sri Lanka, and of course being, you know, kind of normal, educated, Westerner, I used to spend time every day either reading or writing in my diary. And it was not a computer back then, it was a book. I wrote with a pen on page. And most days when I would do that, particularly when I was writing, I would have a crowd of people, not a crowd, but, you know, 4 to 6, 8 people looking through the window of the little hut that I was staying in, and they simply watched me. And, you know, I'd smile and say hi and say, and tell them what I'm doing, and whether I, you know, did it for 15 minutes, half an hour, or 45 minutes, they stayed there. And I asked my friend, who was the reason that I was in that village in Sri Lanka, Titus his name was, I asked Titus, why do people watch me when I'm writing in my diary? And he said, because they don't want you to be alone. Because in their worldview, no human being ever chose to be alone. So they were kind of doing me a favor. They were keeping me company while I was writing, and I've never forgotten it.
I also want to add about that last student, the one that with the big family, is that he's an IT professional, and he had two smartphones and a tablet. He was the one that I always called upon when my technology didn't work or I couldn't make it work. He was amazing. He discovered apps for speed reading and shared them with the class. He was wonderful. And he kind of taught me some things about how to use his phone or his iPad, which I had no idea how to use because, you know, the only thing that I own that you use by moving your fingers on the screen is an iPod Nano. So, you know, there's not much that you can do with that. But, I learned a lot of new things from that student.
Nina, do you feel at all excluded or to some extent a second-class citizen or somehow inferior because you don't have proficiency in those kind of digital devices?
Yeah, actually, I do. I would like to have a smartphone, but I just find them, the expense, too much. I guess I could afford it, but I don't want to. It's like, here, it's $80 a month, I think. To get internet access that you'd need to have a smartphone make sense. It's just too expensive. But I feel like, you know, having been a web head for so long, I feel left behind because here are these new technologies that I've chosen for the reason of expense not to follow the crowd on. And, you know, when it's at the point where every single student in my class has this device, but I don't, I do feel left behind. And people tell me that it's possible to make assignments, I don't know, to get students to use their smartphones to do stuff without having one, but I find that kind of difficult because I don't really know how they do it. Yeah, I'm sure that's true, Claire, and I choose not to add that expense to my life. I know I would want to use it all the time. But I'm resisting here, I guess. But yeah, I have a love hate. It would be a tax deduction. No, I don't get any deductions. I don't itemize anymore because it always came out to be cheaper to do it the other way.
It's ironic, isn't it, Nina? And I know exactly what you mean. I resisted Second Life, for example, and I still do, the virtual worlds, because I just don't see them giving me enough reward for the amount of effort and time and the technological demands required on my system and me. So I think it's okay to be a webhead that resists certain areas of technology. But what this flags for me, I think about a year ago, I started to notice sense of change that it's fairly normal when we're talking about people using or not using technologies, you know, being students or teachers in the digital age, to focus on the question of access. And this was a huge issue for a long time, but Nina, as you say, that you've now got a classroom of students who've all got smartphones. So access is still an issue, and I think that I'm sure the data in the US is about the same, but approximately 80% of Australian households now have the internet, not to mention smartphones. So it's my point is that I started to see not the question of access to this technology wasn't the crucial issue. It was the knowledge to know how to use this technology in a way that many webheads do. I mean, just the fact that we are all plugged into each other and have this inbuilt network that we all call on and accept as normal now, and we all have multiple tools to contact each other and share information and learn from each other. This is a huge literacy thing. I mean, so the level of digital literacy in the webheads is extremely high. And I just think, and as Claire said, if you've got your smartphone, the moment you've got it, you start to do things that you never did. And like a lot of technology, it changes the way you do things. And you don't know how it's going to change your habits until you've got it. And once you've got it, you become part of this other class, the digital class. So I'm seeing very much in my world, I can see the digital class kind of rising to the top. And these are the people who will get good jobs. These are the people who will lead society. And they'll be active in politics and community of development. And there are all these other people who, for whatever reason, and access is not the main feature, are going to be left behind. So it's not just what the digital tools do, It's having the skills and knowledge to use these digital tools to participate in a new and different way that is now separating classes of people. Let's say there are two classes. There are those who can and there are those who can't. And there are those who, quote, get it, and there are those who don't yet get it. Thoughts, Claire, Nina?
I find that a scary thought.
Yeah, well, I guess I did too when it dawned on me because, yeah, it's another kind of class division. I want to jump to another slide, which I've been looking at, not this one in particular, this is just kind of an intro. I was at a conference recently where people were talking about this very much overused phrase, 21st century skills. So again, assuming that designing learning in a digital age is connected with producing students who have 21st century skills, I started to think a lot more sharply about what are these 21st century skills, and you can see there on that slide that's not that clear, but they've the URL there, in fact I'll grab it and put it into the text chat because it's it's worth a look. That takes you to the resources, but if you go back to the kind of home page of that ATC21. This was a group of people who, sponsored by Microsoft, Cisco and some other third corporate party, have spent several years looking at this question of what are these 21st century skills. So they've divided them up into ways of thinking, ways of working, tools for working and ways of living in the world. And just, you know, in preparation for tonight, I thought it would be a good idea to have a look at what they've come up with, and I've just dragged this paragraph out from their kind of summary. That these are the things that they list as the kind of the primary categories of 21st century skills, and we'll move on from here in a minute, but I'll just let you take those in. Well, that's interesting, Nina, because, I mean, when I look at this list, when I was kind of playing devil's advocate with myself, I was looking at this list and saying, well, what's different? Apart from that one towards the bottom of marshalling and expanding the power of technology, are these other things any different to what was always the case? So why do those ones there strike you as particularly relevant, Nina, or particularly 21st century-like?
Well, I think what's different now is in school certainly and possibly in the workplace as well, depending on the job, there is more collaboration. I mean, In our classes, in university classes at the University of Maryland, for example, and I'm assuming it's typical, there's just a lot of group work and group projects. So whereas students, I think, traditionally were expected to work more independently, being able to work collaboratively is a skill that is required more often now than it used to be. I don't know that it started in the year 2001, but it's not just in ESL classes. And I'm looking at the little list that I copied off the website that you posted the link for. Maybe it's possible that things like creativity and critical thinking were less important in a time, you know, kind of in the industrial age. if you think of us as being in the post-industrial age, you know, our whole education system, it is said, evolved to educate people to work in factories or something similar. It didn't educate people to think critically. And I'm thinking again of my Saudi students and the book I read recently called On Saudi Arabia by Karen Elliott House. Her chapter on the education system is a devastating accusation of everything that we think education should not do, you know, just teaching students to memorize and parrot and discouraging them from thinking at all, let alone creatively. So another thing that's different now is this business of serial careers, where students may start out in one field, but then throughout their working life, they have to keep retooling because the job market changes. Just a couple of thoughts. So some of these skills that are listed here maybe would help students to have the flexibility that they need to stay, you know, to keep jobs, to keep finding new jobs, or they have to keep remaking themselves. In contrast to me, you know, I've only ever done one thing. I would have no idea how to remake myself into something else.
Well, I guess I'm similar, and probably the boomers would pretty much fit this profile. I did a lot of things in my younger days until I finally decided that teaching was my career. But once I started teaching, that's all I've done. But I want to ask you this, Nina, and also Claire. I mean, just assume that the question's for you too, Claire, if you've got students or a context that you could address this question or answer in relation to who you're teaching. So you've described your current students, Nina, as being a particular collective profile. Can you see those students, given their current behaviours, skills and knowledge, being able to acquire these skills in red on the slide? Can you see the connection between who they are and what they're doing now and this future?
I'd have to say no. It's impossible for me to imagine my young Saudi students, I'm talking about the ones that have just finished high school, it's impossible for me to imagine them in an American university class. They don't have a clue. They couldn't read what they would need to read. They couldn't write what they would need to write. They don't have the organizational skills to, you know, or the sense of responsibility. These are kids that, you know, they have trouble getting out of bed in the morning to get to class on time. And I'm not saying that all my Saudi students are like that. I have some that are older, more mature. They're headed for graduate school. But thinking of the younger ones, it's really impossible for me to imagine that we can prepare them for, you know, to be students, to be successful students in an American university. Communicate, they can certainly communicate, especially if it's oral. Share, they're good at sharing. I don't know about using information to solve complex problems. As I said, you know, that nothing in their background has taught them how to think analytically or critically. Adapt, I don't know. Marshal and expand the power of technology, maybe. the cultural issue. Well, because of the importance of fundamentalist Islam in their culture, they are, as I said, discouraged from asking questions. Discouraged. Their curiosity is seen as a bad thing, according to Karen House's book that I read, and I don't know how true it is. But it seems to me that often when people say that they don't like reading, it seems to me that this has to be, if there's no reading disability, they're making it difficult. That this has to be related to some kind of a lack of curiosity about the world. They're just not interested in anything outside of their sphere. I'm really painting them with a black brush, and they're not all like that, I hasten to add, but I'm thinking more of a class that I had last spring than the one that I had this past fall. I'll stop talking.
Well, Claire's added that maybe not a lack of curiosity, maybe they just grew up in an environment where people don't read or are not encouraged to question. And again, one only has to think back to several wonderful exchanges on the Webhead list over the years of how people have gone to teach in mostly Asian countries and always struggle with this lack of curiosity, the lack of willingness to ask questions, the lack of or reluctance to initiate. So, and I hadn't thought about that before coming into this session today, but I think we have identified that there's a few cultural issues. But Claire also wrote that she can, when she thinks back to the students that she was teaching, not teaching at the moment, that she'd say that many of the students that she remembers as her students would be able to manage the shift into a world where they were practicing these skills like decentralized decision making, innovation, solving complex problems, and so on. One of the other things that struck me when looking at this list, and I just started reading this 70-page document, and again, to kind of trigger a few thoughts for this session today, was if you look at this list, again, the bits marked there in red, they're very generic. And if you think of the average curriculum, there's a lot more detail down to specific items of competence that these very broad descriptions of skills entail. And I'm assuming that when we go into, in fact, I had a quick scan further down in this document, they do actually start breaking it down, what's it mean to solve complex problems? What knowledge do you need to do that? What behaviors do you need to exhibit and practice and be encouraged? So, but the difficulty still remains, and again, I just scanned the document quickly, that one of the problems that people have when they're trying to design learning for the 21st century is that most of our assessment in the past has been very kind of item specific. And how on earth do you assess someone's ability to use information to solve complex problems, for example? And it's a real challenge. So I'm not saying that these are not true or that they shouldn't happen. It's just that it's another example of how it really requires a complete rethink of everything we do. And not surprising also is the information that we're standardized tests are part of the program, particularly in schools, and this is happening in Australia now, that teachers teach to the standardized test. They teach to a lower level of cognitive development, and basically they're not doing the student any favors when you're teaching like that. In a sense, it's not their fault because the standardized testing is imposing that way of approaching your teaching, but there isn't enough room for this kind of thing. And I just want to move on to another couple of slides, which I think is really interesting. And I'll just first of all go back. Well, hang on, rather than jump around, let me go to the slide. I'm trying to find it quickly. There it is. Now, in the Australian VET sector, that's the sector I teach in, VET for Vocational Education and Training, industry has recognised these as what they want graduates from the VET sector to have, and there's a lot of similarity, isn't there, between the list of skills we were looking at and that document from the 21st Century Organisation. I went looking at other lists, and in Australia they refer to Australian universities all tend to have a list of what they call graduate attributes. So again, these are the things they want their students to learn. So these are the skills that we need to design learning for. We need to design learning to produce these kinds of outcomes. And again, they look very similar to the list of the 21st century skills. And so I'll just come back to, is it this one? No, maybe sorry about jumping around. No. Where did I put this? Here. So there's a comparison. So I've just put put them side by side, the 21st century skills as per that project that was initiated in 2009 and the employability skills from the Australian industry. So these, they just keep occurring. They keep turning up in any list, whether it's schools, universities, vocational education and training sectors, industry councils. There's what they want. They want people who can do these things. So these are the, there seems to be fairly wide agreement that these are the 21st century skills that people need to take an active and meaningful, successful role in modern society. But just begs the question, which I guess comes back to the main question of the session is, you know, how do you design for these kinds of outcomes? And I think it's pretty clear we've got to do it quite differently. I don't think I've got anything to say except a verbal smile, Nina, your comment about honesty and integrity.
I just think it's interesting because, we're trying to teach academic honesty, but it's so easy to cheat, to plagiarize. Now, I read an article last semester that said that anywhere from 60 to 85% of American college students had plagiarized or cheated. You know, it's becoming an overwhelmingly common thing. And then we have a lot of international students that come to us with, you know, they don't have the concept of citing sources, and they do have the concept of collaborating with others. I don't know that they think of it as cheating. They just think of it as, this is how you learn your stuff. You work together with other students. Maybe they do think of it as cheating, and they think it's okay. I don't know. I also just finished reading a book about politics and about how corrupted our system has become. And I'm just, you know, wondering, what about telling the truth? What about, you know, doing your own work? And I don't mean an individual, it could be a group, but, you know, without stealing somebody else's. These seem to be conspicuously absent.
I like the way you're thinking, Nina, because maybe it's something that happens to you as you get older. I mean, I find myself, when I see, you know, an average incident in the daily news where someone's clearly exhibited a complete lack of ethics, a complete lack of values in terms of understanding and care for other people, and what happened to them? Where were the parents? Where were the teachers? Where were the other model adults in these people's lives, or even among their peers, that let them know that you just basically you do right by other people? So, yeah, I like the idea. I might float that in future sessions about this kind of thing. Just, we need to have another item added to these lists. Now, Claire asked whether these are skills or whether they're qualities. And I think I'm inclined to think they're more like qualities. They're like aspects of behavior. And I guess that was my concern that I was trying to highlight earlier. They seem very generic, all of these things on these lists. But again, I'll just use that example. How do you assess the ability to use information to solve complex problems? There was something else you wrote there. Designed for cheating. I'm going to just mention that out loud because I think this is actually part of designing for a digital age or designing for the 21st century. It seems fairly clear. You said it, Nina, that in a lot of workplaces now there seems to be a lot more emphasis on collaboration, and certainly in the way that people are expected to study, it's collaboration, teamwork, negotiation. So if you, and I actually did a search for it the other day on the net and I couldn't find it, but I've heard the phrase somewhere here in Australia, or I don't know, it may not have been in Australia, but I think it's a great phrase. If students are cheating, then your assessment is no good because they clearly give it no value. If the assessment is of any value in the eyes of the student, they won't cheat, they will do it properly. And if you design for cheating, that is, they must talk to each other, they must go and look at a book, they must go and cross-reference other resources to solve the answer that you've posed, then people are developing the skills they need. And cheating just becomes irrelevant. You can't cheat. Now I'm going to stop talking, and we've got just a minute or two to wrap up here and see what this big paragraph that's just appeared in the text chat is saying. Precisely, Nina. So, I mean, and I used to struggle with this. So do you make your, do you pitch it so that's what you're teaching, or can you? And I know I used to do this sometimes. I used to think of scenarios where the present perfect progressive or whatever tense had to be used, because to have the kind of conversation you framed, they had to use it. So you never actually mentioned that structure. You just created an environment, a role play, for example, where they had to use it. So it's that kind of thing in the language environment which needs to be transferred in general to education of all kinds. So, Claire, Nina, any last thoughts before we wrap this up?
I think this has been a really interesting discussion, and it raises a lot of important questions about what we're doing. It kind of raises more questions than it does provide answers. Yeah, as usual. As usual. Sometimes I think that because what we're teaching is language, we can use anything to teach it. So it gives us a lot of flexibility. But at other times, I feel like, well, you know, I need to be aware of what my students need to know and be able to do in English. And some of the, you know, if I don't ever mention, I mean, at some point I have to tell them, well, what's the right way to do this thing, and if what they did was not that way, you know, if they made a mistake in the grammar, or if they used a word wrong or whatever, I have to help them to get that right. And I'm not sure how that fits in with, you know, solving the complex problem. Unless you solve the complex problem to keep the students interested and the language becomes kind of secondary. I don't know the answer to this, I'm afraid. Well, Claire, you pay the bill and I'll get the smartphone.
Nina, I think you kind of answered the question there. So it's not a question, we're not talking about a learning environment where the teacher never steps forward and says, look, this is the right way of doing this. This is the correct structure. This is the grammar. This is the tone. That's still in the mix, but it's not front and center, and it may not necessarily be where you start. And I think we should be probably designing learning activities, and I've actually always thought this, but it takes longer and it's more complicated. Design learning activities in the classroom which have these things, for example, that are there on the screen as the end goal, and the language is the vehicle to get there. And so you are assessing language, people are developing their language while they try also to be the sorts of people who can plan, organize, create, work in teams, etc. So I think it's probably good to wrap it up there. Nina, did you want to say anything else before we go?
Just that I've really enjoyed this hour chatting with you both. And before I get a smartphone, Claire should get a headset.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so this has been Michael Coughlin in Adelaide, Claire Braden Siskin in Pittsburgh, and Nina Liakos in Washington, talking about designing learning in the digital age. So for people who came along later and have been listening to this, I hope it was useful. And if you have any thoughts and response and want to further the conversation, then get into the Webheads email list and share your thoughts. So Claire and Nina, thanks, and it's good night from me in Australia.